My name is Lou Gehrig, and I'm dying. This is the greatest. My name's Scott Redmond, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Okay. Man. If it gets weird, will you tell me? Newcomers, ignore that question. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come and talk today, and I'd like to thank everybody. I love Texas. I love coming to Texas. I love Texas AA, and you guys are just great. We've been shown tremendous hospitality and kindness, and I just always feel incredibly comfortable here, and I want to thank you for all of your kind attention. This is a great weekend for me. I've been having a great time, and I want to thank you for bringing me down with my friend Cliff Roach, and who's a real important person to me, and he's it's just great for us to be able to spend time together anytime, and to spend a weekend together is a big deal, and I want to encourage you to come back and hear Cliff talk tonight. You've had him, this is his third visit to this conference, which proves absolutely that that drunks in San Antonio fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation. But I guess you'll just keep coming, you know, having him back until you remember. And I accept Cliff for what he is, which is a punishment from God. And he's a great guy and gives a great talk. I'm really looking forward to hearing him tonight. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you I have a great life today. And if you're new, I'm sure that just thrills the hell out of you. I'm sure that, you know, Tom, who's taping this conference, I was talking down in Corpus Christi, and the mic went out, and there was a mariachi band playing in the next room. So things are already going better at this conference. And we were joking about it before. He said he was going to slip a mariachi band a couple of bucks to play the Mexican hat dance in the back, because my whole entire talk at this other conference is underscored by mariachi music, which I think did a lot for my talk, personally. If you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you they're going to lie to you and tell you you can't catch it. And I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And my sponsor's fond of saying that the infection takes place at the meetings. It enters through the ear and it infects you and then starts affecting everybody else around you. Thank you so much. And I've found that to be true. I was not an alcoholic when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, if you're a crack monster or the Bigfoot of dope addicts or a tweaker, that's a new one, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and just urge you to catch alcoholism. Just catch alcoholism. We don't have a book for dope juggernaut, you know, but we have a book for alcoholics about alcoholism. And I appreciate it. God, I appreciate these beautiful readings you guys are doing at this meeting. And I appreciate being greeted at the front door. And I appreciate having a prominently displayed copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous when I walk into an AA meeting. Because I get confused. You know, I'll go occasionally to an AA meeting where I won't even hear a passing reference made to God, the Big Book, or the 12 Steps. All I'll hear is about issues and boundaries. And that's fine. But you got to not drink, you see. It's the not drinking part. It's a moose. If it wasn't for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. There's no question about it. You have to not drink to have an issue or a boundary. All right? If you don't drink, you'll have both. You'll have an issue and a boundary. If you're new and you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober. They'll get in touch with you. If you're new and you're curling up to go to sleep and you hear a little voice in your head say, "I'm so glad you could all come tonight," that's your feelings getting in touch with you. If your head hits the pillow and it becomes a rotisserie, that's your feelings getting in touch with you. But I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And you don't want that to happen. You don't want to waste any agony opportunity that presents itself. A funny thing is, my first couple of weeks in AA, a guy who helped me stick around one day at a time as much, if not more, than anything I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in my first couple of weeks, and this guy raised his hand, and he said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means that I do not believe in God, and I am positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I went, wow, man. I went and sat next to him because I want to tell you, that's exactly the way I felt. I had been introduced to an Old Testament God that got your ass no matter what. No matter what. He killed your goat and turned your wife to salt and put a finger in your eye and got your ass no matter what. There was no hiding from him. And you had to speak a foreign language to talk to him. And I would not be caught in a dark alley with this God. I mean, it was really tough stuff. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an atheist with a capital A. I had really forsaken any ritual, any tradition, any sense of a higher power or a greater consciousness or a bigger picture. My life had become so tiny. And I thought I was a free man. And the fact is I found out after I took the alcoholic test. If you're new here, we have a test. It's called an inventory. It's a pass situation. Other diseases have blood tests and x-rays. We have this inventory. I'm sure you're thrilled about it. And when I took the picture of my alcoholism, I realized that, and I really had been under the delusion that I was free. And the fact is I did whatever alcoholism told me to do. I did it whenever it told me to do it, and I did it for as exactly how long it told me to do it for. I was driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-seeking, and self-pity. Driven isn't nudged or influenced. Driven implies under the lash of, in slavery to, driven. And I certainly was. And I didn't know that. I think if I had realized all of that at the same time when I came in, I would have looked like an outtake from Scanners, and my brain just would have blown up. So if you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I hope you catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. If you have a plan for drinking, if you have a reason to drink, I'd like to welcome you to AA. I have a new favorite reason for drinking. I collect them. They just get better and better. I have a new winner. It happened about a month ago. A guy who I was working with lived with his wife, was a male prostitute, and had a gay lover. He called me up and told me he drank. I said, why? He said, I caught my wife cheating on me. It doesn't get any better than that. It doesn't get any better. You can't write that stuff. So if you're new here and you have a reason to drink, share it with one of us before you drink, because if you're new here, I think you're in an extremely dangerous situation. You know, it says in our book, if you're someone with alcoholic tendencies and a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, and we use the word thinking very loosely, the alcoholic mind is like a beautifully exactly tuned clock that keeps the most precise time in the universe for 1 minute and then skips a century. When it works, it is a glorious, rhapsodic thing. And when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through, you know? I was born in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody here from the Bronx? Witness Protection Program? There's you. I'm sorry. No, I'm not really sorry. To a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. And it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. They were completely out of their minds. I had if you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an aunt who took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled. And what happened was her husband got free bales of steel wool because he was a welder. So she filled all the throw pillows with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you went to their house and looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit, you know? The whole room was like a living, breathing thing, organism. Absolutely insane. And I'm just telling you the cute stuff. There was chronic institutionalization, suicide attempts. I had an uncle who was one of the top 10 welterweights of the world. His name was Izzy Redman. He was fighting in Atlanta, Georgia in 1939, and he was concerned about anti-Semitism and changed his name to Izzy Goldberg so no one would know he was Jewish. And I wish I was lying about this. These are my people. This is my genetic pool. And if you're new, all I've got is good news. Because they did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. If my family had truly made me an alcoholic, I could go to psychotherapy and work out my family problems and drink properly. I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. Right? I wouldn't have to say that. I could just be like the regular people. But if alcoholism is really a threefold illness, if it's a bizarre physical reaction to alcohol that makes it impossible for me to stop once I start or to control how much I drink once I begin, and this weird physical reaction only takes place in a certain class of people, and when this weird physical reaction is mixed with this fascinating thinking that makes it possible to ask Cliff Roach back to the same conference three times in a period of time. When it's mixed with that and you keep taking the walk to a drink you can't stop taking, you have to rearrange your life to accommodate the walk you can't stop taking. And the longer you stay in the loop of spree and remorse, the more you have to rearrange. Eventually, every area of my life was impacted by the walk I couldn't stop taking and the drink I couldn't stop drinking. And this soul sickness becomes, this cancer of the soul becomes a reality in my life. And I eventually had to rearrange what was okay to do or not to do as a husband, a friend, a lover, a brother, a son, a father. Everything got impacted by this bizarre thing. And it says in our book, if you ask an alcoholic why he's taking that first drink, despite the attendant misery and suffering that happens every time, if he doesn't slough you off, if he doesn't walk away, if he stays in the conversation, odds are he will have no more idea than you do as to why he's done it. The baffling nature of this illness is one of the most present and pervasive qualities of the disease. So if you're new here and you're confused, imagine my shock. If you're new here and you're bored, I'd like to tell you my favorite story about being bored in AA. It happened to a friend of mine named Jeff D. at my old home group, and he was new, and he was at a meeting, and he was shifting around in his seat, and his sponsor said, what's the matter? Jeff said, I'm bored. And his sponsor said, well, you know why you're bored. Jeff said, no. And his sponsor said, you're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored. And it was like an acid moment for him. You know, he went, wow. It was really cool. He thought, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer, you know. He could hardly wait till a newcomer told him that they were bored. 13 years later, he's 13 years sober. No newcomer has ever told him that they're bored. He's at a meeting with a young lady who's new. She's shifting around in her seat, and Jeff says, what's the matter? She says, I'm bored. He says, well, you know why you're bored. She said, yeah, because I'm with you. So if you're bored, I want to welcome you to AA. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was could not possibly be alcoholic, not only because I was Jewish, but because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy is great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. I got no problem with therapy. My problem is I was trying to treat alcoholism with psychotherapy. Ooh. I was trying to treat a threefold illness with psychology, which is mental, which would be one-fold. So I was two-fold short. I was unprepared. I was showing up at a gunfight with a knife over and over and over again. I'm not putting therapy down. I'm saying I was trying to treat alcoholism with psychotherapy. I was going to be dead with no edible conflict, right? But really, really dead. And it's really even more confusing doing good work in therapy and dying. That's really confusing. It says in our book, in the description of the fifth step, no wonder those in the medical profession have such a low opinion of our chances for recovery, because we've so seldom told these people the truth. And that was certainly true for me. I have experienced, had many, many good experiences with therapy after I worked the steps, but I could not possibly have been alcoholic, because in addition to being Jewish, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years, and what I had also done was I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And this is another way that I really thought that the self-knowledge from therapy was going to help me dodge this alcoholic dilemma I was in. And in addition to that, what I did once I didn't want to be a drunk anymore is I started smoking marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. Right after WOW usually came, what? WOW. What? WOW. What? WOW. What? WOW. What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, you know? There's a lot of activity, but no movement. But there's a lot of crap going on there. They just can't get a claw in the rug. You know what I mean? I was victorious over marijuana with pills. I triumphed over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I got rid of that gall darn cocaine habit with heroin. Heroin's a very exciting, dark, artistic drug. Then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And then I overcame my heroin problem with alcohol and then drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I didn't even begin to catch alcoholism until I was 33 and almost dead from it. And I was about 19, 20 years old, and my father had a massive stroke, and I had shot some dope that day, and I couldn't be there for him or my brother or my mother, and my father was lost to me. I couldn't think about him, I couldn't talk about him, I couldn't look at pictures of him, I couldn't even walk into a hospital and hear the sound of a heart machine, because the sound of the heart machine, to me, was a personal indictment of my complete collapse as a son and a brother and a man. Because I never felt like a grown man my whole life. I used to stand next to men 10 years younger than me and say, I wonder what it feels like to be grown up. And that's a crappy way to live. Because you're almost having a life. You're never having a life, but you will start to have a life when A, B, C, or D happens. And I knew what the problem was. And I swore that I would never, ever put a needle in my arm again. Because that's what had led me to this horrible moment in my life. And I didn't for 13 years. And shortly after my dad passed away, I met a beautiful, intelligent, exotic woman. She was exotic to me. She was from Detroit. And I'd never been out of the Bronx, really, you know? She was exotic to me. I thought there was like palm trees in Detroit or something, you know? And we fell in love. It was very romantic. By the time I got to AA, I had had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a television show, a movie. I had had my own theater in New York. You know, I'd done these things a ton. I never got to do any of them more than once because they'd moved the business after I left, you know, so I couldn't find them again. And when I met Nancy, I was acting in a Broadway play, and she was an usherette in the theater, and we met, and it was very romantic. We had a lot of dreams and a lot of high hopes and a tremendous amount of potential. Potential. Man, stack potential up against alcoholism. Wow. Nancy became very sick from prolonged exposure to me. And she became so sick. We became so sick together that at a certain point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car? I lent you my car." That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, you know? And we were proud of what we had done. It was the end of the month. I looked into my wife's eyes and I said, "Sweetheart, I am so sick of acting like an irresponsible little kid. I don't want to borrow money. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car." And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." She came home one day and I had uh, uh, had an idea to cook something. And she came in and there was a frying pan full of eggs on my chest and the oven was on and I was blue. I was dead, you know. There was an empty vial of pills next to me and she called the doctor and described the situation. Well, first she came in and tapped me with her foot and said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm really tired." And she called the doctor and described the situation to him and he said, "There's a blue Jew on the floor of your kitchen. Call the paramedics." And she hung up the phone and called another doctor for a second opinion. When she tells the story, she usually says, "I hung up the phone and thought for a while," which always puts a little chill up my spine. And I came home one day and we had these 32-ounce tumblers of iced tea tumblers in the house, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine. I emptied the entire bottle of wine into one of these tumblers. And I turn around and I'm getting the pre-Al-Anon rat face. Listen. I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" And completely seriously, I looked into her eyes and I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We had two children who became very sick from alcoholism in our home. When our older son Michael was born, we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls. He was really welcomed into the world. A lot of people at the hospital. 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there was nobody at the hospital, no phone calls, no flowers, no family. We had been completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And Jesse had a little heart deal going on at that time. He was taking a neonatal intensive care, and this doctor called me from the hospital and said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife's all alone down here with your sick child. She really needs you down here." And I said, "I understand that, but the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son." And this doctor, who I had never met before, said to me on the phone, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you my address. Why don't you take your kid over to my house and my husband will watch him so you can come down here and be with your sick baby and your wife." That's a pretty remarkable thing, coming from a stranger and coming from a doctor. And I said, no. There was no way that I could accept that kindness and that help. I was too racked with self-loathing and shame about what our lives had become. And I wasn't doing my son any favor. Now he's locked in the house with this crazy father, hating himself and hating the world, you know. And I would have done better to take him down to the hospital, leave him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have gotten away from me for a while. This is the condition that we came to Alcoholics Anonymous in. But as Bill's story says, you know, when he describes a situation where you can't get any lower than this, he says, little were we to know that this was going to continue for 3 more years. And for us, it continued for 4 more years. And my older son walked up to me when he was 5 years old, and he said, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I looked into the bright, beautiful eyes of my perfect baby, who was just perfect, just the way God made him that morning. And I said, "No, son, there is not." I thought I was giving, I thought I was doing him a favor. I thought I was giving him the real deal. I thought I was going to save him some time so that he didn't have to be played like a sap or a sucker by those lames out there. And the fact is not only did I lie to him, but I gave him really bad thinking. Not only did I tell this kid that he was all alone in the universe, and I mean, we all know what happens when our head hits the pillow at night sometimes. We know what happens to little boys and little girls when their head hits the pillow. And what I basically told this kid is, when you're all alone, you really are. You know, and I try to rip God out of his life. And the fourth chapter of our book points out how really weak this thinking is. That the thinking I thought was had so much bravura behind it, was so gutsy, was so right, is actually couldn't be weaker, couldn't be wronger. You have to be standing in the presence of creative intelligence all around you and turning up your nose at it and saying, doesn't exist. And our family became sicker and sicker and sicker. And on April 20th, 1985, I crossed a line that I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. And that was the line that I had had laid for myself. And my world collapsed around me. And I called my therapist of record at that time, my first Jungian therapist. And I told him what I had done, and he said to me that morning, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you.
I said, what?
He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is that you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Why I went to that AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. I absolutely couldn't tell you. Why I didn't go to the Nut Hut, I don't know, because I would have glad. Most other mornings, I would have gladly chosen the institution. Chance to be with my people, you know, colorful and adventurous people, my people. I mean, in my last few years, I got excited when I was told I needed dental surgery, you know. That's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. There's some heads going on up there. You don't get that at the Rotary Club, right? Only in an AA meeting. Dental surgery. Wow. So why I elected to go to the AA meeting, I have no idea. I walked into that AA meeting. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I put my best clothes on, went to a 7 a.m. meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into that room. Every part of my face was moving in a different direction. You know, I looked like I'd walked out of the GM wind tunnel, you know. And I took one. And if you're anything like me and you're new, you're sitting in this room today and you're saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Welcome. Oh, man. Because you're with the lames now, babe. Miracle, miracle, miracle. Everything was a miracle. The furniture was a miracle. The coffee was a miracle. Miracle, miracle. And if you're new, you are now privy to an unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They're going to get right up in your face and talk that long AA crap to you, man. It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it. Do I want what you've got? No. No. But thanks for spitting on me. I like your belt buckle. Can you serve a whole fish on that? It's really nice. First time I've ever told that in Texas. I'm sorry. I lost my head. Cliff's going like this. Just a poor Jew from the Bronx. I'm sorry. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated every single thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I stayed. The only possible reason that I can imagine that I stayed in AA is because I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray for you that you are out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and share the plan with us. We want to know the plan. I have a favorite newcomer plan. It is the single most utilized newcomer plan in the last 5 or 6 years that I have seen. It's the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack, I'm telling you, because this thing is out there. It is really being utilized. And if you have a plan and you're new, don't use it. And I stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months and enjoyed the gift of step none. You know the gift of step none. Nothing. If you are not using the program of action outlined in our book, and you're not drinking, because drinking works. Drinking is a treatment for alcoholism that works. It kills you, but it works. And if you're not using the drinking treatment or the program of action outlined in our book, oh my God, it's horrifying. You can pick them out at the meetings pretty quick. They usually have a vein pumping like a garden hose on their forehead. They leave a trail of light when they walk. They're a very happy. They're radioactive, for God's sake. And I had just been in AA 6 months, but I had seen the AA drill hundreds and hundreds of times in just 6 months. People came in, surrendered, did the work, changed. People came in, didn't do the work, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, and then shared their ass right out the door. One of my favorite things is when a guy gets up and says, my sponsor told me to share at every meeting I go to. And I always think, then why isn't he here? Why do we have to listen to this? Why isn't he traveling around? Because I tell you, the direction will change. If he had to hear this at every meeting, he'd say, forget it, forget it. And I knew I was going to drink. I had seen it hundreds of times. And what had happened was my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and had begun her miracle. And one thing that was one of the most hurtful and confusing things to me when I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is I attended AA meetings and I heard people telling jokes about Al-Anon. I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we tell enough good-natured jokes about members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking about mean and hurtful jokes. And until I stayed around long enough to find out that those people were just mean and hurtful people and ignorant, although I judge no man, until I was to find that out, I found it very confusing and very hurtful because I was so proud of my wife that she was reaching out for her own miracle. I was so proud of my wife and felt so much hope because of that. And I'd sit in my seat and I'd listen to this stuff and get very, I'd say, geez, I don't get this. Isn't this like a good thing? Isn't this like something we're supposed to be working toward? And it is. And if you're doing that on a public level, then your vote is that it's okay. I used to get all the votes. I'm down to one now. And my vote is that it's not okay. My vote is that it's not okay because there might be a newcomer out there who is lucky enough to be involved with someone who's pursuing their own miracle. And unless you drank alone in a cave, you might have affected somebody else. And one thing, you know, they told me that I got made seven people sick as a drunk. And you know what? If I affected seven other lives while I was a drunk, I'm probably affecting seven lives in a good way now that I'm sober and working toward it and letting that stuff into my life. And I've been asked to share about how I've been living joyously in the 12 steps today. And that's just one other thing I like to share because it's been so meaningful to me. And it was because, in part, because of the demonstration of the power of God in my wife's life and the fact that our children, you see, because a couple of weeks before I got sober, I reached across my dinner table to get something and my son went like this when my arm came near him and my heart broke. I came in AA pretty pissed off, but more than anything, I came in with a broken heart. I came in dying quietly with a broken heart. And that's a place I never even imagined that I would wind up. And the kids were getting less frightened, so I asked somebody to sponsor me at 6 months of sobriety because I knew I was going to drink. And I did something I had rarely done in my life. My whole life, I used to go to drowning people and ask for swimming lessons. And when all they'd say is glub, 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 I'd get pissed off. And what I did, and I don't know why, I do know why in part. Here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, land of the losers. And the prospect of being a loser here was so shattering to me. To be a loser amongst losers was so horrifying to me. I think that's one of the reasons I asked this guy to sponsor me. And of course, I'm surrounded now by the biggest winners I've ever known in my life. And a lot of them were the biggest, I mean, AA losers, you know? People who sponsors told people not to sit next to them at meetings. I mean, the real radioactive losers, you know? And I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he made sure I had done some reading in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he asked me to his apartment, and he read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached the third step, and we said a prayer together, and we got on our knees and made a decision. And then he finished chapter 5, and he went back, and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I signed up. I became a member of AA that day. And I want to tell you, if you're new here, read that book, and read that book if you can with someone who's read it before. Because it'll clear up these meetings for you, I'm telling you. You'll be able, if you're finding these meetings confusing, if you're finding what people say is confusing, read that book with someone who's familiar with it, and you'll start going to the meetings and listening and saying, oh, he's talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what he's talking about. But I judge no man. You know that because I keep telling it to you. You hear some people say that they mostly resented themselves And I know that that's true for them, and I know it's absolutely not true for me. I hated myself, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me, it's difficult to describe it. I'm not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person. I just vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. You go first. That's just me. And I am not knocking the suicide people, right? This is not a put down. Because it's kind of the flip side of the same thing, you know? That's just where I've always gone. So I had a lot of work to do. And it took me 3 months. I went back to my sponsor and I read my fifth step at 9 months of sobriety. And I did step 6 and 7 for the first time. And it came time to do my eighth step list. And I try to share this every time I talk because it's the best reading of the eighth step I ever heard in my entire life. And it was done at my old home group, which was a men's group. And it was done by a guy named Nino. I've never seen him before that night, and I've never seen him since, and I hope I never forget him. He had a heavy New York accent. He was there with a hospital group, and he had never read chapter 5 before. He had hospital plastic on his wrist. And that night, he read chapter 5 for the first time, and he got up to step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what's in here, man?" It was so beautiful. It was so pure. It was the purest reading of the eighth step I've ever heard. Because it's all I saw when I saw the step. It's the only, when I saw the steps, it's the only thing. It became this. No, not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to pay it back. Right? Right? No way, no way. Not the car. If you're new, don't worry, it's 8 steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. And it's not 8 that's really the annoying one. It's 9. 9's really annoying. And I did my 8-step list, and I had to put my wife and my kids and my sponsor down there. And not my sponsor, that was later on. My father. And I did not put myself down on my 8-step list. And it was confusing for me because I heard it a lot of meetings that people were putting themselves on their 8-step list, and I didn't want to put myself down on it. My response said, "Then don't." So I didn't. So I'm just, again, sharing with you how I went about the steps. And plenty of men I sponsor say, "I want to put myself on the top of my 8-step list." And I say, "Then you should be there." And they do. I needed to not be on my 8-step list. I had been making amends to myself at your expense, hopefully, my entire life. I needed to not be anywhere near it. And I know plenty of people who need to make amends to themselves in a really specific way. And I know that I needed to not do it. So I did that 8-step list. I did not know what I was going to do about my father, about my wife, or my kids. What was I going to do? Let's see. I'll sit down with Nancy, and I'll say, "Gee, honey, sorry about this 8-year journey to Hades." Okay? This is where we had wound up, my wife and I. I had high blood pressure when I was drinking. So the doctor said, "You got to lose weight." I said, "Well, I'd love to, but I can't because I drink alcohol and smoke marijuana at night because I have a sleep disorder." The sleep disorder was called amphetamine or something. I don't know. But he said, "Well, why don't I then prescribe some pills for you?" I said, "This is a fabulous idea." So he prescribed for me chloral hydrate, which is a Mickey. It's the thing they slip into the drinks of sailors in those 30s films, and they drink it and fall backwards like a piece of masonite. He prescribes these for me. And I love them. I'm taking handfuls of these things. Nancy's coming home, and I'm slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drops. So now I become incontinent, and I start wetting the bed like any other normal 30-year-old man. And my wife and I, one night I woke up and wet the wall, and the next morning at breakfast, we were excited because things were moving in the right direction. I'm going to wind up at that bathroom any day now. Where? Right? Progress, not perfection. We're moving in the right direction. I mean, this is where we talk about diminished expectations of your life. We're wetting the wall. This is where we wound up. What am I going to say to this woman to make amends? And I didn't know what I was going to do about the wife, about the kids and my dad. And my sponsor said, just do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. See what happens. So I started doing my job in AA. There's some people here tonight from my old home group, people who I've known for a long time. They're two families now, and they're growing. And there's a little girl here who I've known since she was a little girl who I used to see at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I just want to thank them so much for coming here. It's such an incredible thing for me to see this family recovering. And, you know, it's an incredible thing when you come together after years and you both look at each other and you see the power of God in each other's lives, you know. And I know that that's what's happened in my family. And what I had to start doing was I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I had to start, like, going, you know, instead of making some kind of magnanimous apology to my sons, I had to start showing up at flag football games and coaching Little League. Lame, you know. Instead of saying, go do your homework, I had to start saying, do you need any help with your homework? Not that I could have helped them. I mean, they're learning stuff I don't even half get. But I can spend some heroin money on some books. I can spend some alcohol money on a tutor. I can buy materials. I can go into school and advocate for my kid and find out what the Board of Education has available for him. Because by the time Micah got here, he was so scared all the time, his small motor skills were blown. He could barely read or write, and he tested an excess of 168 IQ, and he could barely read or write. He was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He couldn't stop grinding his teeth. He was so distraught from living in this psychological theme park, you know, which was our home, which daddy's coming home today. It's a crapshoot, you know. And this is the state we came to AA in. So if I can dig my heels in and start advocating for my kids and start showing up, then I can start making this living amends. And my sponsor just said, do your job. And the first Little League game I went to, my wife shows up at the game and looks over, and there's all the people in the first base stands, and there's me alone in the sun, pissed off. You know, I'm here. I'm doing my job. I'm making amends. I'm here. The kids were thrilled to see me, you know. I'm going up and down two hat sizes, you know, out of my mind. Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man, I'm telling you, you know. I was crazy. And it took a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number for me to go and just sit in the stands. Just be in the stands with the people, you know. And a couple of months ago, my son Jesse had a music recital at school, and I asked him, where can I sit so I can see you? And I'm at my sobriety station, and he told me where to sit, and he did a percussion solo, and then he got up, looked over some shoulders, and he got me, and he just shot me that much stuff, you know, because I'm at my sobriety station. And I'd sit in those stands once I was able to get over there. And, you know, I sat in this music recital, and I started crying, which makes other parents move away from you, actually. because I'm just in the auditorium with the people. You know, and I want to tell you here today, there's some people who are just at the AA meeting with the people, and there might be a new guy here who's still quick, as Jerry J says, still real quick, you know, got that sparrow look, you know. And you might not be at the meeting with us right now. Eventually, you'll if you keep coming back, you'll wind up here. Thank you. A couple of years going to Little League games, my son, Jesse, received one of the greatest compliments a human being can receive. He was intentionally walked. Doesn't get much better than that, you know. That means they're scared of you, and they want to put you on base. Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that. And Jesse didn't want to be a geek and jump up and down and scream and yell, you know. He just put his bat down. And he trotted up the first baseline, and on the way up the first baseline, he turned to me in the first base stands, and he just hit me that much. Just gave me that much stuff. The old man, you don't want to be lame, you know, not too much. And I could have missed the whole thing. As Norm A says, by a second and an inch, I could have missed the entire thing. And I'm not telling you my son got intentionally walked because I'm sober. I'm telling you I was at my sobriety station because I'm sober. And in my first year of sobriety, my son, who I told there was no God, I started sponsoring men very early in sobriety, at the end of my first year, and I'm very grateful that I did start to do that. And this guy who I sponsored at that time used to call the house. His name was Roland, and he would leave a message on my machine every night. He'd call, and the machine would say, "Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Good night." And years after this, my son Micah, who I told you was so distraught and so messed up from alcoholism, years later, Micah told me that he could not fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the tape. And once he heard Roland's voice on the tape, he knew nothing had changed and it was safe to drift off and go to bed. And this is the kid who's, I try to rip God out of his life, and you guys came over the phone machine, under the door, through the back door, through the window, and you seeped into our lives and you put the God back in there. Not that he had ever gone away. And of course, Micah told us this years later when Roland was convinced that he had not helped anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told this this exactly when Roland needed to know it, you know. And my wife, who's just terrified of me, I'll just give you an idea of how scared she is of me at this point. Micah had to go to the dentist, and I said, she said, "You have to take him to the dentist." And I said, "Oh, I have to take him? Where will you be?" She said, "Where will I be? Let's see. I'll be dancing around the house naked, screaming, 'I'm not taking him, I'm not taking him.'" Okay? It's a wonderful program. And in my first year of sobriety, I fancied myself a show business big shot. I had a writing job for 20th Century Fox, and at the end of that year, I took my first year cake, and I was becoming sort of a spiritual Goliath at that particular time, and I had I was being considered for a job to direct a situation comedy, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank, and I was humiliated. I went to my sponsor, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me, "Well, I guess you have the show business God." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you have the show business God. The show business God has failed you utterly, and I guess you're going to drink." And he said, "You better get a God big enough so that you get to not get show business jobs." You know. And when I came into AA, I heard people talking about God getting them jobs, getting them into relationships, God getting people parking spaces. Oh, no, not the parking God. Not the parking God. Not the parking God. And if you have a parking God, why don't you be of service? Next time he gives you space, give it to the person behind you. Pass it on. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I realized I had to get a God big enough so a lot of things could happen in his universe, and I didn't get to drink. And I wrote the resentment against myself for almost drinking, at the company for not giving me the job. And I did 6 and 7, and I said, "Pop, I humbly ask him to remove these defects." Humbly is not, "Take him if you can, big guy." Humbly isn't, "Take him, you rotten son of a bitch." Humbly is, "I have had it. Can you help me out here? You're keeping Saturn on its axis. Maybe you can do this." "I've had it. Can you do my work and then reveal your work to me and I'll do whatever I can do?" That's 6 and 7 to me, you know. And I said, "Pop, take it. You can have show business too. I have had it. Take it. I am willing to do anything for a living. Just don't let me drink." And 3 months later, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, "I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. I did not mean this." In L.A., when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer. The caterer follows them around and feeds everybody, and it is a really good job. You make a lot of money. I mean, the most money I've ever seen a cook make for that kind of work. But I'm Scott Redmond. And the first movie that I catered, the executive producer and star was a guy who I had worked with in the business before. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning, and he said, "Can I have a burrito?" "Scott?" And I turned around and said, "What's happening, babe?" He said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." I got off work and I called my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift of sobriety now. It's a miracle. He said, sounds like you've got a resentment. So I sit down and I wrote, I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. Now, resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No biggie. Work a step a year. Don't hear that pearl very much anymore. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. What am I going to ask God to take away? The burrito, the truck, the guy? What am I asking God to remove? What is it in me? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. He comes, touches me on the head. What is it in me if it disappeared? This resentment, this fatal resentment would be gone. I'm grandiose. How dare a man of my caliber work, make money, and bring it home? I'm playing God. Things aren't going according to the Scott Redmond program. A fabulous program. I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along. I'm a retaliator and judgmental. I never have to open my mouth for that. That just happens when my head hits the pillow and it becomes a rotisserie. I'm ungrateful. Guys get sober, they don't even get to work. I'm not only getting to work, I'm making good dough. And this is the list I had to go to my God with and say, Father, can you help me out here? Can you help me out? Please remove these. Tell me what you want me to do. And my inner voice said, show up and give them a dime for their nickel. When somebody shows up at that set who you've directed, I wound up feeding actors who I had directed, stage managers and associate producers and associate directors who had worked for me. And every time I wanted to run behind that truck and hide, God said, I'm either everything or I'm nothing, pal. What are you going to do? You're going to go be a proud cook or an ashamed writer-director? What's the best life for you? And I started showing up and doing my job. And I had a friend named Paul, and I still have him today, and he used to say this this prayer to God. He used to say, Father, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just keep me sober, and please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. Paul R. I was so glad that I could be of service to him. And I had it all wrong. I had thought I had fallen from a height, and I didn't know what the top rank in Alcoholics Anonymous was, which is Child of God. And once you attain that rank, there's no place to fall from. You have no place to fall. And I was able to help some guys who thought they had fallen from a height. I had a friend named Dave who was used to be a really big rock and roll star, and he wound up, he was a year or two sober, and he was had a job digging fence post holes in the San Fernando Valley in August. Great job. And he was with the 17-year-old kid, and the kid starts cracking up laughing. They were both sober. And Dave said, what's so funny? And the kid says, I was just thinking, you know, I always wanted to hang out with rock stars. And Dave and I really helped each other a lot because we both thought we had fallen from a height until we achieved Child of God and started living comfortable lives in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I cooked for about 3-4 years, and then I got contacted by a company called Ketchum Public Relations in New York, and I was up to get a big comedy writing job, and I really wanted this job, you know. And the old brain fever came back, you know. And I was just, you know, I had to do a videotape for him, and I got the brain fever, and I crashed and burned before I even heard about it. I wrote the 10th step, I released it, I got God involved. Shortly after that, I get a phone call from Ketchum that I didn't get the job. I was fine. I hang up the phone rings again. It was my company, catering company, asking if I could go up to Lake Arrowhead, which is in the mountains around L.A., and cater a commercial. I said, fine, fine. I got in the truck, and I got up there, and I grabbed the call sheet, which tells you all the information about, you know, the company you're working for. And I look at, who is the commercial for? It's for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm videotaping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. He's going to tape this and take it back to New York and show the guys in New York, and the guys in New York are going to say, oh, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? Oh, my God. I get off work, and I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're really getting the gift now. Oh, are we getting the gift? America, America, America. He said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as he's having a good time. Oh, man. Our kids have had a remarkable recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my son Micah, who I told you was so scared, I was a couple of years sober and I was making the boys lunch. And I said to Micah, what do you want on your hot dog? And he said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. And I said, lettuce? And he went, oh, I don't want lettuce. And he walked away and he came back about 45 minutes later and looked at me directly in the eyes. And I am not altering one syllable. He said to me, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me at that point. A while ago, Jesse broke his wrist in a growth plane, and if you know anything about little kids, when they get hurt in a growth plane, it can't be disturbed once it's set because it's a growing area and it's a pretty serious deal. And I came home and Micah was playing too rough with him, and I got right up in Micah's face and I screamed at him because this was a limit that had to be set. It wasn't up for negotiation. And I chewed him out and he walked away from me and walked into his room and slammed the door. So now I got the dad tick. You know, this one, I'm going to slam the door, you know. So I go to the door, and I open the door, and I go like this, and he says, hold it. I didn't tell you you were wrong out there. You were right. But a big guy just got in my face and screamed at me. I'm not telling you you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad. What the hell is that? What the hell is that? That's the result of practice. Because my wife taught me how to fight good. As a member of AA, if I really wanted this thing that we were doing in our home to work, that I could learn to fight good, because I hadn't fought good ever. I either screamed at you till you shut up, or I cried till you shut up. I bullied you either way. I used the tyranny of helplessness or the tyranny of my size and my volume. And both worked. I'm good at both. And when my wife wouldn't let me do it, and she'd let me go through my crap and go, so, and then stay with it until we finished, I started learning how to fight good. My kids started learning to fight good. I stopped because I thought my amends was to keep them safe and not arguing, which was hurting them. I wasn't letting them ever finish a fight. So it would just come up again, because nothing ever got finished. And we started having a house where we learned how to fight good. And I started acting like a grown man for the first time in my life. And when I really applied the sexual inventory that's in that book to my life, not in terms of just sex, but the kind of man I want to be and the kind of marriage I want to be involved in, extraordinary things started happening. Our book asks us to write about where I've been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate. Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And what should I do instead? Not what could I do. What should I do? What could I do? What I did. What should I have done? Something vastly different. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Where have I been dishonest? Well, when I started looking at that, it was pretty shattering. A grown man ought to live in a clean house, right? That's something a grown-up would do, live in a clean house. But I'm not cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I think somewhere in the back of my twisted noodle that a certain amount of housework should be rewarded by a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. So I'm never cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I'm cleaning the house and going, I'm finished, honey. When I started to clean the house just to live in a clean house like a grown man, I started feeling like a grown man for the first time in my life. Now, I don't like to clean the house, and I don't know how. So I started doing it for God. I'd say, Father, I'm cleaning up for you. And me and my sons do it together every weekend. We take a time where me and my boys just clean the house together. You know? Miracle, miracle, miracle. If you're new, I'm sure you can someday clean the house with your sons. I'm sure that thrills the crap out of you. They don't show that on light beer commercials. Have a beer, clean the house with your kids. And I started doing stuff for my wife that I didn't want to do. She loves a cup of coffee, so I started setting up the coffee machine. So the minute I'd hear her hand on the knob of the house, I'd hit that button so I could see what happened to her when that fresh coffee would hit her lips. And I loved it. She loved it. Now here's the hook. The next time we have a fight, I don't get to say, what about the goddamn coffee? The coffee's out. If I want to recover, I can't use the coffee as a weapon. You know, and these amends started getting made. I was a couple of years sober, and one of the guys I sponsor told me to take a hike and ripped off some people in AA, and I just kept my mouth shut. I didn't tell the guy what I thought. And when the guy found out he had a fatal illness, I was the only guy he could call because I was the only guy who hadn't told him, he hadn't blown out. And I got to be there for a guy during his death when I couldn't be there for my father, and my father came back into my life. And he didn't come back in a big flash. I just found that I was able to hear the sound of a heart machine without feeling guilty. I found that I was able to look at pictures of him. I was able to start telling his grandsons about him because my sons had no relationship with him because I had no relationship with him and I couldn't talk about him. And my sons started appreciating their grandfather for the first time because I could tell them stories and we could look at pictures. And you guys put my father, that black, horrible hole that was never going to get filled with anything, was gone. And several months ago, one of the men I sponsor was dying, and he died in a room being held by me and four other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We took the first three steps together, we took the seventh step together, and I looked in my sweet Jimmy's eyes, and I said, do you know that you've done good work here? And he looked at me, and he said, oh, yes, I do. And he turned to a guy by the side of the bed, and he said, I'm okay, I'm sober, and he went to God. How can such a thing happen? How can such a thing happen in a room filled with losers? I mean gigantic, colossal losers. It's happened because you put our hand in God's pocket and you put Jimmy's hand in our pocket. And I can't even tell you, if you're new, how happy I am for you. How happy I am for you that you're in this conference, in this room with a great enthusiastic group of alcoholics with this great hospitality room downstairs and stuff. I can't tell you how happy I am for you here. And I want to tell you, if you're new, I think you're in a very, very dangerous situation. You know, because basically what we're saying to you is, if you are beyond human help and you need a spiritual experience to get sober and you haven't had one yet, we just want you to not drink until you have it. You are in this horrible half-lit world where you don't have the thing necessary to stay sober, and we're asking you to stick around long enough to get that thing. When you go for a root canal, the doctor doesn't say, okay, now go forth and do other root canals. But we do. We do. We say, here you go. And my book says, tell a man he can get well. My book doesn't say the road gets narrower. It says life gets bigger. Join us in the firing line. See what you can help pile into the mainstream of life. It talks about the great reality, the broad highway, the big idea. It never talks about life becoming exclusive. It talks about it becoming inclusive. And my life has just been, and I mean the biggest amplifier of my life is I am able to actually take pleasure in the good fortune of other people. This is an extraordinary difference in life. You know? And again, if you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, geez, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. To which I usually reply, no, your mind is the furthest thing from your mind. Now, I'm not knocking you, but I just want to tell you why I'm so unimpressed with the fact that drinking is the furthest thing from your mind. To the best of my knowledge, virtually the entire Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is engineered to try to drive home one point. That if you really have alcoholism, if you have this bizarre mix of physical and mental and it becomes spiritual, if you really have alcoholism, then when drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, you put whiskey in your milk. You cross the threshold of the hotel and say, geez, a couple of cocktails would just be swell with dinner. That no matter the attendant misery and suffering, no matter how often it's happened, you are in this loop of spree and remorse, and no human power can extricate you from it. It doesn't matter the proximity of the drink. It just matters if you've got this thing. And I want to tell you that the spiral of recovery is, for me, just as powerful as this spiral of disease. Because here, if you can make a little surrender, you can maybe make a little commitment, and maybe that commitment will allow you to make a bigger surrender. And the spiral of surrender and commitment is incredible. And sometimes people say that pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth, and it is. But it's only, for me now, a touchstone of spiritual growth, not the touchstone. Because quite often, joy is the touchstone of spiritual growth for me. I love this thing. I'm having a great time, you know. My wife and I are celebrating 20 years of marriage next month, and it's not because God likes us better than the people who are getting divorced. It's just what's happening in our house. We got whacked by the Sherman Oaks. We live in Sherman Oaks, and we got creamed in the earthquake. I mean, creamed, you know. And shortly after the earthquake, we were at a function out of town, at an AA function, and a woman at the function said to me, "I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake." So I said, "Oh, so he likes you, but we're crap. But he likes you, so he got you out." And she said to me, "I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." Oh, bartender, I'm out of here. I'm out of here. If I got a guy up there saying, "Get the Redmond boy, get him. Get him. Kill his wife, turn his, kill his goat, you know, get the, break his china," I'm out of here. For me, I know today that God is spirituality and earthquakes are geology. This is just for me. You know, because if I got that God saying, "There'll be no evacuation plan for the Redmond family," I'm out of here. And Nancy and I are having an exciting, romantic time together. We're having a great time. And again, it's my God, doesn't care if we stay married. And again, this is just for me. I got to do my job in AA. If I'm getting divorced, I got to do my job. If we're together, I got to do my job. That's not because God loves us more. It's just what's happening in our house today. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to suggest that you stick around long enough to catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. Please, we'd love to give it to you. Stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. One of the greatest moments I've ever had with a newcomer was I was on the phone with a guy, and Nancy was passing through our bedroom, and all she heard me say was, "Let's say the aliens are coming." She stopped short. She ain't missing a second of this, right? I said, "That's an outside interest. I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. I have one question for you. Why are they here for you? You're 10 minutes sober. You have no life. Why have they traversed the universe for your sorry ass? Don't you think they're going to call the cops or something? Why are they here for you? Plus, he's sleeping with a Bible on his chest to ward them off." So they're going to come across an entire universe and say, "Oh no, the Bible, let's go home." One time I was sharing this at a meeting, and the guy who was on the phone was in the audience, and I saw him, I was telling the story, and I saw him go like this, "Ha ha, oh man." He realized it all flooded back on him, okay? If you're new here and the aliens are here for you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.